This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
You know, has some relatability there as far as being a student of knowledge, but what about hadith really attracted you, especially someone who's coming from a Western academic background?
Well, first of all, I mean, I feel it's, you know, I really have to say that I'm, you know, people always say, oh, you're a scholar of hadith or something, but that's not true. I mean, I know very little about hadith compared to, I mean, even kind of a middle range hadith scholar in Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Pakistan or Malaysia or something. I mean, I know relatively little compared to those people. I think, you know, I've studied enough that I can, you know, I've studied enough with traditional scholars to be able to access information, to know when I don't understand things, to know how to find out when I don't understand things. But I mean, what I try to do really is two things. One is to kind of answer specific questions that I have regarding Islamic intellectual history and how we understand the religion. And those questions really come out of my kind of questions as a Muslim about, you know, how do we understand Islam as Americans or today or given all the different pressures on us? And then the second thing is, you know, I try to communicate the Islamic tradition and especially the Sunni Hadith tradition. I try to communicate this to audiences that don't have any real experience with that. So, I mean, I don't want to, you know, a lot of times people think I'm some kind of master or something. That's not true by any stretch of the imagination. But I've figured out how to kind of try and communicate these things to audiences who have little or less knowledge than I do. But the reason I got interested in hadith is because, you know, hadith is always, it's always about other issues in the sense that it's called the servant science in Arabic, the servant science, in the sense that, you know, hadith is a category of information, a category of data. And so it gets used for everything from law to theology to ethics to history to, you know, even, you know, historical information, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, when you study hadith, you can just study the science of hadith, of criticism, you study the compilation of hadith. Those things are kind of specific to hadith per se. But once you go beyond that, really you're talking about everything that could possibly be drawn out of that body of knowledge. So it's the same thing as studying the Quran. I mean, you study the Quran, you know, you're studying, in effect, everything that comes out of the Quran, which is everything in the Islamic tradition. So, and unlike the Quran, which is a very relatively small contained body of information, the Hadith is, the corpus is vast. And so a lot of, just by sort of dint of the very question of mass and number of reports, a lot of the things that, you know, most controversial for Muslims today or have been even for the past 150 years, are from the Hadith tradition. So everything, you know, it's like, you know, whatever the issue is, like jihad or Islam and women's rights or Islam and gender or Islam and slavery or Islam and, you know, you name the issue, chances are the crux of this, of the matter is going to boil down to Hadith. So that's why it really interested me as kind of something that you had to get into in order to be able to discuss these issues.
Yeah. Since we're talking about Hadith, I'm glad you mentioned that. For instance, you know, as far as Imam Nawawi's 40 hadith, right? There's a few questions we have about the 40, you know, of Imam Nawawi for you. One of them is, we have a hadith of Rasulullah ﷺ where he says, "I was ordered to, you know, umirtu an uqatil an-nas. I was ordered to fight the people until they say la ilaha illallah," right? And obviously, there's an explanation for that. But for the Western mind, how do we make sense of that? You know, for our listeners, for our audience, and Muslims in general in the West, because on the face value, the hadith seems as if it's going against the principle in Islam, la ikraha fid din, right? No compulsion in religion. And Rasulullah says some straightforward is saying that I was ordered to fight the people until they say la ilaha illallah.
I mean, this is actually a pretty easy question to answer. Yeah. I mean, so you know, when you there's numerous different versions of that hadith, you know, in the six books, in Bukhari, in Nasa'i, and Tirmidhi. And this is just from my memory. I'm not making any mistakes, but, you know, there's versions from Anas, from Abu Huraira. I think there's a version from Omar, if I'm not mistaken, radiallahu ta'ala anhum. You, whenever you deal with the hadith, you have to collect all the different versions. So, I mean, like, it's attributed to Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal and also Yahya ibn Sa'id al-Qattan, that, you know, if you don't collect all the different versions of a hadith, you can't have any fiqh, any, like, understanding of that hadith. Yes. Because, you know, let's say even in Sahih Bukhari, or like take Sahih Bukhari and Muslim together, or just one of them, if you look at any hadith, chances are you're going to have, with only a few exceptions, you know, the vast majority, you're going to have a lot more than one narration of each hadith. And those narrations will differ in important wording versions. Like anything that's recorded, sort of reported along a chain of transmission, you're going to have vagaries in transmission, people who remember things differently. And people who add things in that they think were there, but that weren't really there in the beginning. And so this is quite normal. And so if you don't look at all the different versions together, you won't really be able, you might come away with a skewed understanding of what the report was originally. So in the case of this one that you're mentioning, you know, if you look at the different, was one version in Nasa'i, Sunan Nasa'i and Mujtaba, where it's, I think it's from Anas bin Malik, he says, or the Prophet says, Umirtu an uqatil al-mushrikeen. I was ordered to fight the polytheists. Now, and that, of course, you know, when you read this hadith initially, right away you know it can't be taken at face value, because that's not true, because the Quran says that when you fight those people who don't, you know, fight those people who don't believe in, believe in God in the last day, and don't forbid what God forbids, and don't allow what God allows, and don't believe in God in the last day, fight them until they establish the prayer and pay zakat or pay the jizya.
Yeah.
So from that Quranic verse, you know that actually the Prophet isn't commanded to fight people until they say la ilaha illallah, because they're also allowed to retain their religion and just pay a tax.
Yeah.
So right there and then, you know, either the hadith is abrogated by the Quranic verse, or the hadith has to be reconciled with the Quranic verse.
Yes.
And so when you go and you look at the other versions, you find actually there's another version where it specifies it's the polytheists that it's talking about. And then you can say, oh, well, that means that, you know, okay, so Muslims come across Christians and Jews and Zoroastrians, and they can all keep their religion. But then Muslims come across Hindus, and Hindus are polytheists, so then they have to fight them until they all convert. Well, we know that's also not true, because we know that from historical practice of Muslims, that basically anybody they encountered, they treated as people of the book. And that mushrikeen is specifically only referring to the polytheists of Central Arabia. That's the only group that Muslims were allowed to fight until basically they converted or they had to convert or die. Every other group Muslims have come across, whether they're polytheists or monotheists or dualists or whatever, has been treated as people of the book. And that's in the Hanafi school of law. That's because they think that the Quranic list of the people of the book, the Jews and the Christians, the Sabaeans, is not a complete list. That's just examples. And in fact, it could be anybody you come across. As the Prophet specified Prophet showed when he said to treat the Zoroastrians like people of the book. In the Shafi Hanbali school of law, they think that the Quranic list is exhaustive, but then they say that anybody else who has anything like a book is like, it's called Shibh Ahlul Kitab. They're not technically the Ahlul Kitab, but they're like them, just like the Zoroastrians. So basically, in whatever school of law or interpretive approach you take, in the end, Muslims treat any group they come across as people of the book, who, i.e., they're allowed to keep practicing their religion and pay jizya tax.
There's two options also that people mention, and you know, just if we just get your feedback on that. One is that Rasulullah was living in a time where it was a very warlike culture internationally, right? It's still like that, but it was more tribal, and you know, that was the way things were conducted, and a type of healthy intimidation that may have taken place. The second thing is that Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam would only make a claim like this after being a part of a sovereign entity, right? A Muslim can't just, you know, take a hadith and say, well, if Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam said this, I can just go and kill anyone I want whenever I want. You know, there's actually a whole entire process that has to occur, even contemplating going to war. You know what I'm saying? So are those, do you think those are valid points? Because that's, a lot of people have that mindset too, even on a scholarly level.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the hadith doesn't say you go do this. Exactly. It says I have been commanded to do this. Yes. I, as the leader of the Muslim community.
Yes.
And in addition, as you know, we said, you know, people have other, you know, everybody except the polytheists of Central Arabia, who are all Muslim now anyway.
Yeah.
They have an option, which is to, you know, if Muslims conquered them, they could just keep their religion. In fact, that's what the vast majority of them did numerically. Yes. In Islamic civilization.
Of course.
So I think that if some Muslim goes off and says, this hadith means that I can go kill someone if they don't say La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah, that's just, I mean, that's, that person is, you know, you could give them a Chinese fortune cookie and they might go kill somebody. I mean, they're just so stupid if they think that, you know, I don't know. That's my opinion. I don't know. Maybe, you know, especially teenagers, God knows what they think. But I mean, my point is that, you know, that's the very poor understanding of that person who decides to take that action, not a responsibility of the Prophet.
Sure. Dr. Brown, also, we talked a little bit about like the Ahlul Kitab and the Jizya, etc. A lot of times when we hear people talking about Islam in a negative light in the media, whether it's the alt-right or neo-atheists, etc., they're always talking about these, you know, well, there's the concept of the dhimmis, right? And they classified as second-class citizens. And from their perspective, like right now, because with they're like, let's say American citizens and they have rights as primary citizens. And they're like, well, under Islam, we would be second class citizens. We wouldn't be the main class of citizens. So just being devil's advocate there, doesn't that seem logical for an average person to therefore think negatively of how the Ahlul Kitab are treated under an Islamic government, for example?
I mean, I think it's just comparing two totally different. It's like comparing apples and oranges. I just don't even know how. So basically, you know, when, you know, in the United States, we have all sorts of people, all sorts of classes of people in this country who don't enjoy the legal rights of citizens, whether they are permanent residents, whether they are immigrants, whether they're illegal immigrants, whether they're visitors from other countries on visas, right? So there are all these other people who are second class citizens in effect, right? I mean, in the sense that they don't enjoy the rights of a citizen. We don't sit around pulling our hair about that. We say that's just a natural extension of how we conceptualize citizenship. So this whole idea, you know, in Islamic civilization, like the vast majority of the world's population, not all, but the vast majority of the world population prior to the emergence of the nation state in the late 1800s, early 1900s, you know, identity was based in a great part on confessional, i.e. religious identity. You know, so, a citizen of the Islamic civilization, a citizen of the Ummah, was a Muslim, and then there were people who lived as protected minorities.
Yes.
And like permanent residents and immigrants and all these other things that you have in the United States, they didn't enjoy the same rights as citizens. They also didn't have the same obligations as citizens.
That's the main thing, obligations,
you know, I don't see why that's so disturbing. And then they say, oh, but, you shouldn't do that on the basis of religion. Well, actually, I mean, to be totally fair, that's actually more fair than the way we do it, because if you were Jewish or Christian and you want in Cairo in 1300, you wanted to become a full citizen, all you had to do is say La ilaha illallah Rasulullah, and you became Muslim. Okay. Whereas today, if you're an immigrant or an illegal alien or whatever here in the United States, you have no means to become, in order to become a citizen, you have to, that has to be an application that's accepted by the U.S. government. There's a long process you have to go through. So I think, If you really wanted to compare the two systems, a system where it's a person's choice to simply adopt a new religion and instantaneously become part of this, you know, the totally enfranchised class, that's much fairer than a system where you have to, where someone can't do anything because they happen to have been born in a different country.
That's a nice perspective, man.
I mean, and then in terms of, you know, someone says, oh, if we lived in an Islamic state, we wouldn't be full citizens anymore in America. What the heck are these people smoking? I mean, what do you realize what kind of changes would have to happen demographically in this country for it to be a quote unquote Islamic state? I mean, so here's one possibility, I guess. We could be conquered by some all-powerful Muslim nation that would take over and make us part of some Islamic state. I don't see that happening anytime soon, so I don't even know why that's on the radar screen. Or the vast majority of Americans could convert to Islam, in which case the country would be so different. This whole conversation would be completely obsolete.
Yeah, of course.
So, how about this? I, Jonathan Brown, to the extent that I have any authority in this world, okay, if America becomes an Islamic state, I will personally guarantee that non-Muslims will not be relegated to any dhimmi status, okay? And I will gladly sacrifice my life to protect their rights. And by the way, we have precedent for that, like the Ottoman Empire in the late 1850s abolished the jizya and abolished any discrimination between different religious groups within the empire. And by the way, did that using precedent from the Islamic tradition and drawing on the Kitab al-Sir of Muhammad bin Hassan al-Shaybani, the famous Hanafi scholar who died 805 Common Era. So there's...
But there's also advantages of being a dhimmi status, though, right? In the past, I like reading up on history, but I remember reading that the dhimmis in Islamic history didn't have to serve in the army. They had they were excused from doing those kinds of things.
But almost nobody. I mean, one of the weird features about Islamicate civilization is after basically the early to mid 800s of the Common Era. Regular Muslims just living don't ever serve in the army until the 19th century. Right. Because what they do from that point on, either the dynasties employ slave soldiers who are drawn from outside the Muslim world and then they become Muslim, but like the Mamluks, as you guys love to call yourself, or the Abbasids, Turkish slave soldiers in the 800s and the 900s, or their government is made up of sort of military, basically warlords and their troops. They're usually Turco-Mongol troops. And no normal person in Islamic civilization really served in the army from around 800, let's say, to 1800.
Right. Right. I think if you understand like the purest form of Islamic governance, if you look at the Rashidun Caliphate, you would see at least those principles related to the dhimmis being practiced in its purest form, like where they were granted many rights that Muslims didn't have to adhere to, like serving the army.
Well, yeah, I mean, they were allowed to, they were allowed to drink alcohol and buy and sell alcohol and raise pigs and, engage in transactions that were interest-bearing transactions. So they were allowed a lot of things Muslims couldn't do, yeah.
Right. Well, what we were talking about earlier in regards to Hadith and trying to get the big picture of what the Hadith is talking about, with, like, for example, the Hadith that Sheikh Hamer brought up. When people who are English-speaking are evaluating a compendium of a hadith relating to a certain subject, well, what are some warnings that they should adhere to? Because there's a lot that's lost in translation from Arabic to English, and they're trying to evaluate hadith in that respect with from an English angle.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a matter of translation. I think that in general, people should not really read hadith books because it's such a...
You mean without being in the tutelage of somebody, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like imagine, being just getting reports about something that, let's say like Harry Truman said on like some day. I mean, it's just completely decontextualized and trying to figure out how to fit them together and what they mean is a big challenge. This is one of the big challenges Muslim scholars have had, and to sort of someone who doesn't have any background in that, it's just going to, they're going to go crazy. They're going to not know how to deal with this. Which is why, your there's another saying of, you know, early Muslim scholars, Sunni scholars from the 700s, 800s that, you know, hadiths are, will lead astray anyone who's not able to understand them. You know what I mean? That you're, if you're not from the Ahl al-Ilm scholars, then you try and read this material, you'll just be befuddled and probably misled and misguided. And, you know, this, you know, it's amazing. I mean, one of the pieces of evidence for the overall reliability, especially the more, you know, books like Bukhari and Muslim is that the language is extremely archaic. I mean, the kind of images that are drawn in the hadiths are so, they're so foreign to even Baghdad in like the 780s. I mean, even kind of an urban Middle Eastern context, these are a totally different world. This is people living out in the desert and, you know, living off different parts of animal bodies. I mean, it's when you come across this imagery, I mean, even Muslim scholars in the 700s and 800s of the Common Era, it was really hard for them to understand some of this stuff. I mean, they sat around like banging their heads against the wall trying to figure out, what does this mean? What is this type of plant they're talking about? Or why are they saying that this is like, you know, the armpit of a camel? I mean, what do they mean by that? It's a totally different world that you come across in this material.
Dr. Brown, in light of that, so like, you know, hadith scholarship has been around for what, several hundred years. And I'm going to ask kind of a loaded question about a certain personality. So, it's at your discretion if you want to answer or not. My background, not right now, but in the past, in my younger years, I was pretty active in the Salafi Dawah, or what we call Dawah the Salafiya, if you want to be a little bit more formal about it. And one of the main personalities that, you know, these brothers or sisters are, you know, in this movement are attached to is Sheikh Muhammad Nasruddin al-Albani, rahimahullah. And he's very polarizing because a lot of people who are traditionalists will say, well, he'd have a teacher, etc. And, you know, and sometimes, and after leaving that whole ideology, you know, you kind of understand that, like, well, there's a lot of like hype and slogans and stuff thrown around certain scholars. What's the, you know, I don't know if you, like, if you've studied him in any depth, but what's your take on him? What's his methodology? And like, how can someone in the 20th century come across and say, well, this is Sahih, this is Hassan? Like, hasn't this already been done? Or was he getting access to new, you know, books of hadith that, or other, you know, texts that people weren't necessarily coming across?
So, with the case of Sheikh al-Albani, rahimahullah, there's a couple of things one has to keep in mind, which is that there's a lot about people that causes conflict that's not just their ideas. I think he had a very kind of caustic, combative personality. I think if he had said things in a different way, if he had, you know, expressed himself in a different way, probably he would have had less conflicts with people. So I think some of it is his personality. And then second, I think the, you know, most of the real controversies about him are not about his hadith scholarship. It's about his legal rulings, you know, that, let's say women are not allowed to wear gold rings, and not just men, that, recovering the face is not required and things like that. I mean, so it was, I think, his legal rulings, and then his rulings on theological issues like, tawassul, visitation of graves, intermediation by saints and things. And these are the same things that, you know, Salafis and non-Salafis are always arguing about. So I think part of it is just sort of this thing Salafis not argue about regarding theology, some of Albani's particular legal rulings, you know, the fact that he didn't constrain himself to any madhab. So, I think the majority of things that are controversial about Albani actually have to do with those issues. His hadith scholarship is, you know, I've never seen anything from Al-Albani that really differs from any other, you know, from the sort of range of normal methodology of other Sunni hadith scholars from the 700s to the 20th century, right? I mean, he's not like he has some methodology for authenticating or declaring weak hadiths that other people don't have. And if, you know, people might disagree with his opinion on something, but they might also disagree with Ibn Hibban or, you know, Abdul, you know, Duri or Dawraqi or Al-Mundiri or someone. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, this constant disagreement amongst Sunni scholars on these topics, on particulars of hadith judgment. So that's not unusual. Third of all, I mean, I think that his book, he did tremendous khidmah, he did tremendous service to the study of hadith. I mean, if you just come across any hadith and you say, I want to know if this is authentic or not, you know, it's not like every hadith out there has rulings on it. It's actually really hard it takes a lot of work to go through an entire book and rate every hadith. And very few Muslim scholars ever did that. And so, you know, if you find a hadith in a Mu'jam of a Tabarani or in the Jam of a Tirmidhi or something like that, and you better pray that somebody somewhere gave a ruling on that hadith's reliability. Otherwise, there's no guarantee you're going to find that information. Well, Albani actually did. He actually went through a huge number of books and gave for every single hadith his opinion. And he backed it up with evidence. And that was a substantive, a real important contribution. And one of the reasons people always cite Albani isn't because he's some kind of, you know, he's some kind of superstar in hadith, you know, whose opinion matters more than anyone else. He might be the only person who ever offered an opinion on that hadith. And that's an incredibly valuable service.
Yeah, he was a game changer for sure.
Yeah, and then if you look at his, you know, if you look at his discussions of, you know, why he considers hadith to be weak or strong. You know, he lays out his reasoning, and you can disagree with his reasoning if you're qualified. And that's, you know, but that would be no different than if you were looking at a Dhahabi or Ibn Taymiyyah or Ibn Hajj al-Asqalani. You would have probably the same kind of disagreements, because this stuff, a lot of it is based on judgment calls and weighing evidence. That it's not kind of doing math problems. It's an art, not a science.
Well, and that's really eye-opening. I actually didn't know, because the question in my head was, you're always afraid to ask it to other, because you're, you know, fearful of being ostracized from the gang. But like, because I was like, well, hasn't this work already been done? And then and you explained it. What? No, it hasn't been done.
But also, let me also, you know, something you asked is important that I address, which is, the science of hadith study never ends. And this was a debate that I actually talked about this in my first book, The Canonization of Bukhari and Muslim. And I think I mentioned it in my book on hadith as well. But, you know, there was a big debate that starts in the 1200s over basically a misunderstanding of something that one scholar writes. And, but the debate is basically has the process of, you know, authenticating or, de-authenticating hadiths, has that ended? And basically everybody who mattered said, no, it hasn't ended, because as famous scholar of Cairo, Zain al-Din al-Iraqi said, "Ala hadha amal al-muhaddithin." This is the job of hadith scholars. It never ends. Now, if there's something in Bukhari that Bukhari thinks is sahih, then unless it's a very rare exception, probably no one else is going to say it's not sahih. I mean, just, not because they're afraid of disagreeing with Bukhari, but just because, statistically speaking, if he's very, very selective. And so if he says something's authentic, probably other people also said that, as well. And, the hadiths in Bukhari and Muslim are a very small number of hadiths. We're talking about, you know, anywhere from 2,000, you know, basically let's say 5,000 or 6,000, maybe 7,000, 8,000, depending on how you count what a hadith is versus different narrations of the same tradition. But you're talking about a relatively small number of hadiths compared to the massive number of reports that are compiled found in all the different books of hadith, compiled in Islamic civilization. So, you know, what they're talking about is, what about all those other hadiths out there? I mean, look at, let's say, Ibn Majah's Sunan. Ibn Majah's Sunan is not a sahih book. So when you want to know if a hadith is reliable, and that someone has to go and do that work. And it's not like someone a year after Ibn Majah died decided to do that for his book. The first book that was even a commentary on Ibn Majah's Sunan wasn't written until the 1300s. So people were constantly and still remain in the process of looking at hadiths that are found in different books, trying to authenticate and trying to figure out what their status is. And because, again, this is a process that is inevitably subject to disagreement, people will also be evaluating the work of others.
Sure, sure. Dr. Brown, I got one more question regarding hadith. So when I was growing up, and maybe it's like around late high school, early college, one of my best friends, he came to me with this Quran, and it was a Mus'haf, sorry. It was technically, let's say he's a Mus'haf, it's a translation, and he was talking about how there was like, you could be a Buddhist Muslim or a Christian Muslim, and that lard was permissible because only, you know, pork meat was. And I was like, where are you getting this stuff from? And he gives me this Mus'haf, and it's like some version of the Quran interpreted by a guy named Rashad Khalifa. You heard of him?
Yeah, he was in Arizona, and he was murdered. Yeah,
you know, he's the number 19 theory, but he's like a subset of this Quraniyun movement, right? And the argument that, and at the time I didn't know much about hadith myself, but as I learned a little bit more, I was, you know, talking to my friend about it, and his argument was always like, yeah, but there's always this human element with a Bukhari or a Muslim that. Cause they're not fallible. They're not infallible. And so with that, there's like a, you know, chance that you're not getting the right thing. So that's why we just stick to the Quran. And, you know, there's a lot of strong arguments against the Quraniyun movement, but people, a lot of like, I find some people who are still want to hold on to that. And it's funny, the people that kind of hold these beliefs are really average lay people. But that's like that's the thing they hold hard to. Like, there's human error still in hadith, even if it's like 1%. And based on that, we can't say, like, we can't have certainty for instance, that this is like the truth. You follow what I'm saying? Like, how would you respond to that?
Well, you know, I think it's important that, you know, it's important to affirm, you know, that, yeah, you know, Muslims are only required to believe in things that they can know through certainty, with certainty, right? That has evidence that produces certainty. So, usually these are called things that are what's ma'lum in ad-din bidurura, or axiomatic tenets of the faith, or things that are known necessarily as part of the religion. And a lot of, you know, the vast majority of details of Islamic law and dogma, or, you know, whether or not you believe a certain hadith is true or not, these are things that, you know, might be wrong if you don't believe them, but you're still a Muslim. No one can declare you an unbeliever for that. And so I think it's important that if people say, you know, I feel so much doubt when I come across any hadiths. No, I really just want to stick to the Quran. I mean, I understand that imperative. I understand that sentiment. And, you know, we need to give people their right to kind of have a bare minimalist understanding of their religion. And as long as they don't deny things that are known essentially as part of their religion, then, you know, they would be fully Muslim. You know, as far as I understand it.
But would there be a problem, for example, if they were to say, we don't, because sometimes those guys, well, they're like, we don't have to follow the Prophet Muhammad.
So here's the thing. The second part of my answer, which is that, you know, one of the things that you have to know, you know, have to believe in to be Muslim, is that you have to believe in that there's five prayers. You have to do five prayers. You know, if you don't pray, then you're just a bad Muslim. But I mean, if you don't believe that's part of the religion, then you're not a Muslim. And the problem is that you cannot get that from the Quran on its own. So there's things that Muslims know and have always known is part of their religion, but that can't actually be clearly gleaned from the Quran, which means there has to be something else besides the Quran that informs our religion. And that is the Sunnah of the Prophet. Now, we can sit around and debate till the cows come home what the Sunnah of the Prophet is, how we should know it. And that's the job of Muslim scholars throughout history. And that's why you have different, you know, Sunnis and Shiites and different schools of law and different schools of theology, because there's disagreement about what the Sunnah of the Prophet is. But you have to acknowledge that there is this other source that's in addition to the Quran, which is the Sunnah of the Prophet. Thirdly, the issue is if someone says that they only follow the Quran, that gives them certainty because, well, how do you know what the Quran means? I mean, you might know that this is the word of God, authentically preserved, but to actually understand it, you're going to end up with lots of interpretations, inevitably. So you'll whatever certainty you have in terms of what's called the thubut or the attestation, the historical reliability of this document, that certainty is not going to be sufficient to give you certainty about what the book means, because meaning is subject to interpretation. Finally, how do you even know what the words mean? Oh, you say, well, we look, and I wrote this in my most recent book, when I was responding to, this one translation of the Quran done by one of the students of Rashad Khalifa, a guy, a Turkish scholar who I think also lives in Arizona, whose name is Edip Yüksel. And he did a translation of the Quran called the Quran Reformist Translation. I think it's what it's called. You can get it online in PDF. And, what he says is, I'm only going to use the Quran. I'm not going to take any information from outside of the Quran in my translation. And he does that pretty well, except, you know, he actually is using something. It's called Arabic Dictionary. And Arabic dictionaries, it's not like, you know, some guy was sitting there writing the Arabic dictionary at the time of the Prophet, and then we just happen to have that dictionary or something. Dictionaries were written by Muslim scholars using the exact same material that went into the Hadith corpus. So the same people who are transmitting Hadith are the ones transmitting the meaning of Quranic words, the meaning of this word, meaning of that word in Arabic. So you cannot escape reliance on something outside the Quran or to understand the Quran. It's impossible.
Okay, Dr. Brown, let's segue into like a more practical question. A lot of folks see, like, a lot of up and coming brothers and sisters in our community in high school, they want to study Islam in an academic field. They see people like yourself, Dr. Yasser Qadi, or elders like Dr. Sherman Jackson, etc. For someone who wants to study Islam in the Western Academy, what theological or spiritual prerequisites would you recommend for them to make sure that they're not derailed in their faith as they undergo that pursuit?
I mean, I wouldn't suggest that anybody study Islam. I mean, if Muslims want to know about their religion, they should study their religion with scholars, with Muslim scholars who are going to teach them their religion in the traditional Islamic way. I mean, I tell this to Muslim students. I say, if you want to learn your religion, don't take classes with me, because my classes are not about teaching people about Islam as a religion. They're about Islamic intellectual history. They're about history of the Middle East, history of the Islamic world. And, when we read texts or something, you know, I include a lot of Islamic a thought or a perspective of a Muslim scholar in that, but it's not taught from that perspective. And, you know, even if I'm Muslim and I, you know, believe strongly in my religion, I don't talk and teach in that way when I'm dealing with students, because, you know, in a classroom, because, you know, our universities are not places where you're allowed to favor one religious perspective over the other. You have to be able to switch to different perspectives. And so, you know, sometimes Muslim students used to take my classes. I remember when I used to teach at University of Washington in Seattle. And they would get very upset when I'd say stuff. And I'd say, look, this is a history of Islam class. I mean, I'm not, you know, let's say I give a Shia interpretation. That's still a Muslim interpretation. And that would still upset you. I mean, I can't, you know, I'm not here to just give you Islam as you want to understand it. It may be the correct interpretation, but it's not the only one, and I don't have the right to favor it over others and other perspectives when I'm talking to a broad audience. So I think that people should really learn their religion from Muslim scholars in mosques or in madrasas or in, you know, centers of learning that are developing in the U.S. and the West, or on different online forums. They have different teachers who do classes online. I mean, I think that's really, if you want to go and take classes on it, like, for example, let's say a student wants to take, I'm teaching a class next semester, sexuality and power in the Islamic tradition. the student wants to take that class, that's fine. But if they go into that class and they don't know and they just think they're going to learn about their religion, they're going to get, their brain is going to get blown on the first day. I mean, they're just, they're going to start pulling their hair out. Not because it's not about Islam as a religion. It's about the Islamic tradition, which is, a historical tradition that has tons of stuff in it that has nothing to do with the religion of Islam. So, you know, I would say if you go and you get a really good grounding, you know, not even not a really good, but just a decent grounding in the basics of Islamic faith and law, then you can go and learn, you know, take classes with professors and you can have a degree of confidence. You're not going to be shaken by what you hear.
Right. So, I mean, I guess, so like what, let's say some, a 17-year-old kid comes to you, right? And I know you're doing some work right now, as I understand it, with the Yaqeen Institute. And we know, we've had some of the folks from Yaqeen already on the show. 17-year-old kid comes to you, like, hey, Dr. Brown, like, I got into Harvard, right? And I want to, and I also have this, and he's studying with scholars on the side. What should I study at Harvard? And I want to do a PhD. What would you advise him to do for, like, I guess the intellectual warfare that is essentially being fought in this country right now?
I mean, first of all, I would say, why are you doing a PhD? Because you probably won't get a job because there's not a lot of jobs. But let's say he says, look, I'm independently wealthy and I can do whatever I want. I would say don't do Islamic study because Islamic studies is a very, in theory, this isn't the case, but in reality, you know, a lot of people in it are, like, you go, if Muslims go into Islamic studies, which is now, I don't know, I would guess the field is maybe majority Muslim now. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think it might be the case. But even a lot of those Muslims, they really, like, they lose a lot of their iman. I've seen people, like, even at Harvard, that's just, for example, Harvard, I've seen people go into those programs and get chewed up. Like, their iman gets chewed up and spat out. By the time they graduate, they're, you know, drinking, marrying like non-Muslims, you know, they don't believe anything anymore. They're totally jaded and cynical people. And that's not because a better argument was given to them. It's just because when you go into a culture, like if I went, you know, if you guys went and spent like 6 years in some neo-Nazi skinhead camp, you'd come out neo-Nazi skinheads because that's what happens to people when they go into environments. They're affected by their environments. That's the nature of human beings. By the way, don't go into any neo-Nazi skin camp, skinhead camps. So it's not just about the stuff you're learning. It's also about the way you're acculturated to thinking about religion and what's important in life, about issues of meaning, about whether or not you're going to be jaded or not jaded. And a lot of these, you know, a lot of professors in the humanities, They're train wrecks. They're personal train wrecks. They're alcoholic. They're miserable people. Their families are disasters because they're deeply neurotic people who are incredibly self-centered and unconcerned with others. And, you know, if you want to go and find a group of people that you wanted to learn from and be affected by, professors are usually not the best. I mean, they're borderline non-functional people a lot of the time. And I say that as a professor, right? So what I'm trying to say is when you go into Islamic studies, you're not just, it's not like you're just going to go and read books and learn in some disembodied relationship. You're going into a guild, an academic culture, a lifestyle, and a group of people who are going to influence you. And I think, you know, Islamic history and Islamic studies are fascinating. Lord knows I love them. But, you know, I survived all that, you know, thank God, by the grace of God, and with a hell of a lot of resilience. And I took a lot of hits, you know, and other people didn't go through. And I happened to be fortunate enough that when I was in grad school, there was a lot of Muslim students like me who were very knowledgeable, were older than me, who could protect me, who could help me, who I could turn to for advice. And we helped each other. You know, we gave each other strength in numbers. And that was, but a lot of times that's not going to be the case. So, you know, I would say if someone says, I'm going to go to Harvard now. And I would say go and do a PhD in Western intellectual history. Go do a PhD in, you know, in literature, in linguistics. Go do a PhD in law. Because almost all the stuff that all the stuff that we worry about today as Muslims in the West, you know, Islam and this, Islam and that, Islam and terrorism, Islam and jihad, Islam and women, Islam and, you know, gay rights, all these things, like all these things that we're always being bombarded with. These aren't about Islam. This is not about Islam. This is about the West and the insecurities and inconsistencies and unreconciled elements within the Western tradition. And if you read a very good book called On the Muslim Question by Ann Norton, I really recommend this book. What she shows very well is that on whether it's violence or gender or marriage or women or freedom of speech, freedom of expression, everything, all these things, they're really not about Muslims. Are just the they're just the tool. They're just the screen on which the West projects its anxieties, its internal anxieties, right? So, and one of the ways this works is that we have these sins put on us. So, you know, for example, right now I'm writing this big thing on slavery, for Yaqeen. And, you know, I just finished writing it today, actually. And, you know, what's fascinating about slavery is that, you know, people say, like, is there slavery in Islam? You know, what does Islam say about slavery? Why does Islam allow slavery? Now, in that question that the person is asking you, everyone assumes that it's the Islam part that needs to be clarified. That's the question. But actually, that's not the question at all. Islam issue is actually relatively simple. It's slavery. What is slavery? If someone actually sits there and tries to define what it is, the definition will immediately start falling apart. And the more you pursue a definition that would operate outside of a narrow American context, the more you realize none of your definitions are working. Every definition you come up with doesn't fit everything you want to call slavery. And the definitions that do fit are so general, they're totally useless. So what you realize is that when people say, you know, why is Islam allow slavery? What they're really saying is, I think slavery is X. And if you're American, you mean, I think slavery is this abominable practice of treating a whole race of people like subhumans and working them to death with no rights, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not what slavery is for most of human history in other places. In fact, if you went to other places and times in human history, you might not even realize that you're looking at slavery. You might think that a free person is slave and the slave is a free person. I mean, you wouldn't, you know, a lot of situations, the things that we think we know about slavery don't apply at all. So what's actually happening in the situation is Muslims didn't engage in race-based plantation chattel slavery. Muslims did not engage with this. Only very, very rarely in Islamic history was this allowed. And it certainly wasn't part of the way that Islamic law conceptualized slavery. Okay. But when Muslims are asked, why does Islam allow slavery? What we're basically being asked is, slavery is this horrible thing which we all see in 12 Years a Slave and we watch Roots and Amistad and things like that. And why do you guys allow that? We don't allow that. Don't come and pile your sins on me. You guys did this stuff. Well, actually, my people did. My ancestors owned slaves in the United States, so I'm guilty. Right? But my point is that you know, Muslims didn't do that. I say, oh, well, Muslims sold these people into slavery. Actually, yeah, some did. But if you read Rudolf Ware's excellent book, The Walking Quran, what you see is that even before the first abolitionists were organizing in England in 1785, 1786,
sorry, what book was that? The Walking what?
The Walking Quran.
The Walking even Quran.
Before,
okay.
The Walking Quran, yeah. Even before the first meeting of the Abolitionist Society of Britain took place, I think it was 1787. Even before that, in West Africa, a Muslim state had been formed, led by a scholar named Abdul Qadir Khan, who was so sick of seeing Muslims enslaved by French and Spanish slave traders and seeing the people who memorized the Quran bound up in chains that he rose up in rebellion against the like drunken Muslim ruler at the time, who, by the way, was drunken on alcohol he bought from European slave traders in return for slaves. Okay, the Europeans gave them alcohol and firearms, and rose up, defeated these slaver kings, and prohibited slavery in his kingdom. He prohibited that if anybody was a slave, if they could say even one phrase of the Quran, they were freed. And he prohibited selling slaves to, he prohibited the Europeans from coming and taking Muslim slaves. So, you know, this whole discussion, a lot of these discussions, Muslims have the inconsistencies, the unresolved internal conflicts of the West, of the nation state. They have this piled on them. We become the bearers of these burdens when we are not responsible for them.
That's an awesome perspective.
I mean, so this is like, you know, just, I mean, to go just to keep on this example of slavery, you know, it was, oh, well, in the 1700s and 1800s, the Barbary pirates, these Muslim pirates in the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, were enslaving British people and American people and things like that. And yeah, but you know what? No one knows this, but Europeans were enslaving Muslims from the Ottoman Empire at exactly the same time.
Right.
You know, people, it's astounding wherever you can point in Western culture to some fear of Muslim slavery or objection to moral objection to Muslim slavery, at exactly the same time, exactly the same custom is happening, practice happening in the West. For example, in 2015, I think it was the summer of 2015, all the newspapers in England were all in uproar because they're in this place called Rotherham in north of England. There was this circle of Desi, you know, South Asian Muslim sex traffickers who were luring white girls into be their sex slaves. And in fact, yes, there were Muslims who were doing that. But guess what didn't get reported in the media, except for one or two places, is that the majority of the people who were suspects and the majority of the people caught up in the investigation were white men. But Instead of looking at that, instead of looking at the fact that males in our country, in the UK, in the US, are engaging in unacceptable sexual practices with young women, they just look at the Muslims and make them the villains, therefore exonerating the society as a whole. And that's what I mean when I say Muslims bear the sins of others.
Yeah. And now, Dr. Jonathan, we're living, it seems like, in a post-Trump era now, and I'm trying to figure out.
Well, we're not even a pre-Trump. We're still in pre-Trump. He's not president. Come on.
No. I think, well, the message we got from our.
Up when the post-Trump. In 4 years, then we'll be post-Trump. That's all. But yeah.
Well, the message we were getting from our community leaders and whatnot was that, you know, don't freak out yet. You know, he's not president, but it seems like from his appointments that he's been doing so far, there's some definite warning signs and just to allude to what you were talking about earlier, what are some tips or things that people can do or young kids can do to further their career? Or let's just say you have a 16-year-old. I don't know how old your kids are, but let's say you have a 16-year-old and they say, hey dad, you know, things have changed and you know, I want to contribute to Muslim society. How do I contribute now? Well, what's a way forward?
I would just say that I would say, first of all, you know, as there's a great line, the Odyssey, you know, each soul delights in the task that suits it best. And also, you know, in the hadith of the Prophet, kullun muyassir lima khulika lahu. You know, everybody is, what you're created for is made easy for you, you know? So people should find out what their talents are and then go in that direction, because not only will they be more effective in what they do, but they'll also be happier. People are happy when they're doing what they're good at. And so I would say in terms of what you should do, what the kids should do, it would really depend on what the kids' talents are and what the kids' opportunities are. But I would tell, you know, I would tell the kid, look, you have to excel. Whatever you do, you have to excel. And this is, again, goes back to the teachings of the Prophet, you know, in the hadith of the Prophet, that God wrote kataba al-ihsan ala kulli shay. God ordained ihsan, you know, perfection in everything. If you do something, do it well. So, you know, whatever you do, do it well and be committed to it and be passionate about it. And people will respect that. And people respect you as a Muslim because of that. And then you'll gain, inshallah, you'll gain excellence and prominence in your field. And then you'll be able to speak out as a prominent person in that field. I mean, being an activist is great. It's very important. but it's also extremely important for there to be Muslims established in all these different fields who can speak out as successful doctors, lawyers, writers, illustrators, whatever, car engineers, who knows, people who have excelled in those fields. And then to be involved in their communities, to be committed to engaging government, to engaging civil society in the United States, to going out and being involved in their mosque community and reaching out and being involved in the interfaith activities, doing charity, trying to improve the society around them, trying to improve the lot of Muslims in the United States. And then to engage also with different levels of government, whether it's getting on the local school board, which is extremely important, extremely, extremely important job, or going into local government or going into even, you know, higher up political career. This is really important for Muslims to do. Muslims should never doubt the correctness of engaging in society and politics. That's very important.
Now, in light of that, you know, we had the situation which just popped up in the last couple of days where ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, was known to have, you know, come together and do an alliance with the AJC, the American Jewish Committee. And, you know, in light of some of the rhetoric, there was an alt-right conference, I think, this weekend in your neighborhood.
I think they announced the formation of the council the day after the Trump election. So
was it? Yeah. Something like that, you know? And some of these, like, some of this white nationalist movement would be anti-Jewish and anti-Muslim, right? Yeah. And so a lot of folks would say, well, yeah, we should collaborate on things we agree with, and, you know, things that we disagree with, we won't collaborate on. And we talked about MLI on a previous show with some other guests of ours, you know, and your position, as I understand it, as most people would probably, who know you, understand it, is that you're pretty anti-MLI. You know, I think there's enough information on the internet about, like, your cause, but is this alliance, and now ISNA actually stepped away and backed off a little bit, they qualified it, and some pro-MLI folks actually got really upset. They were espousing
their
views.
Yeah, I saw that, actually. This was just pointed out to me, well, you know, maybe an hour ago or so before I started to talk to you guys. You know, look, there's a couple of things we have to focus on here. One is, so my problem with MLI has nothing to do with Jewish people or Judaism or even Zionism. That's not the issue. My problem with MLI is that it is two things. One, it is designed to undermine a successful boycott effort. Okay. If you don't want to be involved in the boycott, that's fine. But don't participate in efforts to undermine it. Okay. And that's all been demonstrated by Sana Saeed's article on faith washing and all these things. And as you said, this has all been well established, and you could probably provide your audience with links if you want on your podcast or something like that. Right. Okay. The second problem is that it is not the business of people who are not from the Muslim community to choose who Muslim leaders are. Find me another community out there in the United States where it allows its leadership to be selected by people outside the community. By the way, people who have, as far as I know it, the Shalom Hartman Institute in Israel does not have the best interests of American Muslims in mind. Okay? They advertised that their interest in MLI was in combating the BDS, the Boycott, Divest, Sanction movement. Okay? So just, these are two very simple principles, and I've never heard anybody who can actually counter those arguments. The pro-MLI people, they twist into all different shapes and go through their kaleidoscope of arguments, but they've never been able to respond. Say, oh, you have bad edib. Oh, you know, even the Prophet talked to his enemies. The Prophet didn't talk to his enemies. First of all, there's nothing wrong with talking to anybody, but you don't talk to someone if that action is going to be used to undermine some successful effort to undermine it, to oppose an important cause. So that's that issue. The second issue, if the other partner is not asking you to compromise anything that you don't want to compromise, or is not making some requests of you that are damaging, then I don't have a problem with that partnership. I mean, the Prophet, alayhi sallam, allied with mushrikun, polytheists, he allied with non-Muslims, he allied, you know, but if they came and said, you know, we want you to compromise this religious belief or that religious belief, he would of course not ally with them. So there's a long tradition in Islam of allying with people who are not Muslim, who maybe even don't have Muslims' best interest in mind. But if there is a shared goal or a shared strategic objective, then you can ally with those parties, provided they don't ask you to compromise on important things, or provided that your partnership does not in and of itself undermine an effort. So, for example, with the MLI, the reason why that's problematic, if Muslims did MLI in Switzerland or in New York, they went to a mosque in, or a synagogue in New York and worked with them, or they met in Switzerland or Japan or wherever, that would be no problem. The problem was that it was done with an Israeli institution that insisted that the people come to Israel to learn there, and that's in direct violation of the BDS boycott. So that's my problem with MLI, not the idea of partnering with people who are not Muslim.
In your various discussions or debates with the pro MLI crowd, has anyone ever said something to the effect of where it's kind of like a low blow, where they would say, Hey, Dr. Brown, the reason you're so passionate about it, to be honest, is just because your family that you're married into is Palestinian. Has anyone ever, I'm just curious, like, has that ever come up in some of the dialogue?
No, it's, although people have told me, these people are saying this about you, that you're just doing this because of your, it's funny, they say, apparently I've heard two things. One is that I'm a misogynist. I don't know how that fits in. Apparently I'm a misogynist. And two, and quite ironically too, I'm influenced by my wife and her family. I both hate women, but I also, and I'm unable to oppose the influence of my wife. Neither of these things are true. My best friend is a woman. It's a joke, people. I'm not laughing at that.
I was like, wait, what?
My wife is my best friend.
I thought it was some random chick who was like undergrad at Georgetown.
I'm like, man, this is a liberal scholar here. Maheen, what did you get us into?
You guys didn't get my joke. I'll attribute it to the technology. But the point is, I've been pro-Palestinian since I became Muslim. Because I didn't even know, until I became Muslim, I thought Israel always existed. I didn't even realize it was a new country. American public is so ignorant of these things. Yeah. The second I saw what was happening, I saw this short movie called The People on the Land. I started bawling with tears. I remember it was my sophomore year in high school. I just started bawling when I saw what was happening. The people, the children being killed, the houses being torn down. And I couldn't believe that my tax dollars were paying for this. I couldn't believe I didn't know about this. I was so upset. And since that moment, I never had any doubt about the tremendous injustice that was being done to Palestinians. And of course, everyone says, oh, Palestinians are so violent. Why do they always blow stuff up? Why can't they use peaceful means? Why can't they be more like Gandhi? Okay. And then the second they say, okay, we're going to just boycott. We're going to call people to boycott Israeli institutions. We're going to call people to divest from Israeli companies and institutions. Then, That's also bad. This is just nonsense. I mean, these are just efforts to take away all the means that Palestinians have to resist the tremendous injustice that's being done to them. And, BDS is totally peaceful. And all it asks you people to do is not to invest in Israeli companies and not to, formal relationships with Israeli institutions. So basically my point is that, has anyone ever done these low blows? Not to me in person or online, because I can deal it out pretty effectively. And I don't think that, if somebody wants to say that to me, then,
Dr. Brown, did you?
They're going to get a nice response is all I can say.
Did you notice, that there are quite a few like Twitter celebrities? These Twitter celebrities are kind of being cherry picked for certain people's causes from outside our community to represent Muslims, and if you kind of look at it from that angle, you'll see that, certain people are kind of being propped up as being the voices in our community, and they're not necessarily representative of us.
Maybe even people who have, moderate amounts of talent to not that talented to unable to write coherent articles, Yeah. So if there's a, by the way, if there's a, if you really want to keep a community down, make sure their leadership are mediocrities.
Right.
Because then they'll never excel.
Right.
So yes, I think that is not at all a, that is not a chance. This is a very, this is a well thought out and a well time tested plan for managing minorities.
Right. Create division and, from the message itself will end up breaking apart once you create some splinters within any movement. And while we kind of argue amongst each other, the message is lost, kind of.
Well, yeah, or just make sure people, I mean, if your leadership is unable to create an effective and moving vision for the future and to respond to outside challenges in a constructive way,
right,
then you will never be able to, you know, to move beyond the condition you're in.
Yeah.
Cool. Hey, Dr. Brown, first of all, jazakallah khair for coming on the show. As we wrap up, what's the best way, or if people want to learn more about you, where can they find you online? It sounds like you're pretty active on social media. We kind of hinted that out already. I mean, some of my, like, I got another story before I'll tell you. One of my friends, he was at UChicago with me that day, and he was telling me how he had never, like, fanboyed anybody. He met Shah Rukh Khan one, you know, the Bollywood actor, and he was like, yeah, not a big deal.
Yeah, but of course. SRK.
You know? And he was like, he saw you, and he's like, he saw this, like, you know, sharp-looking white dude up there speaking Arabic and talking about Usul al-Fiqh. Because I think you were talking about, like, foundations of Sharia and the Madahib, etc. And then, you know, and he was just – and he really got into you because of one of your debates – that you were having with one of these pro MLI folks a few years ago, and then he jumped on her, and they started having beef, and so he was like, "Yeah, so you became like his champion."
Oh, well, I'm happy to have been inspiration to somebody.
You know, so
I think it's really unfortunate. I don't actually dislike these people at all. I mean, I think that some of them, you know, like, you know, Wajahat Ali, for example, this guy's a very talented guy. You know, he's he really has a chance to help Muslims. He's already done important work to help Muslim community. You know, just like just earlier today, I've, you know, put his name on an invite list for something at the university, and Rabia Chaudhry did this Serial thing, which I didn't listen to because apparently I'm the only person in the world who didn't listen to this. and you know, she advocates for criminals to be to get due trials and stuff, and that's great. And, you know, Haroon Mohul occasionally writes things that are really interesting and insightful. And I mean, I think these people have, you know, they really have a capacity to help the Muslim community out, and they have done so already. You know, but, they've really kind of insisted on something that I think is deeply, deeply flawed and for a number of reasons. And moreover, they've repeatedly brought it up. Like, I mean, I actually don't write about this issue unless somebody, like someone from MLI or pro MLI writes something. I mean, this thing that happened a couple weeks ago where, Rabia Chaudhry got a prize, was given to her in Chicago, and yeah, then this organization retracted the prize because they found out she was an MLI. You know, if that had happened, no one would have known about it. I mean, but she posted something on her Facebook page where she said this happened, and she posted the letter, and she posted this long moralizing essay objecting to the organization in Chicago. Well, why did she do that? I mean, no one had to even know about this. But the second she did this, you know, it was going to be clear that this Chicago group was going to have all sorts of grief directed at it. So I responded and I said, you know, this is I applaud this organization in Chicago, and I urge people to support them because they're going to take a lot of heat.
Yeah.
And that turns into me, you know, being obsessed with this issue and not letting it go. I'm not obsessed with it. You know, if this, by the way, if this MLI thing had happened and they'd gone on this thing and just everyone had been quiet, no one would have known about it. No one would have cared.
Right.
No one would have cared. But what happened? They went, and then the first thing that publicly happened is Rabia Chaudhry wrote this article. Like, it was must have been summer of 2014. That what an American Muslim learned from Zionism, you know. And she wrote it, and then, you know, if you do this stuff and then you write articles on time.com about it, of course you're going to catch flack.
Yeah.
But by the way, that was the entire point of this project. The entire point of this project was to have Muslims do this openly, because this was going to make it, the idea was that there were going to be a number of Muslim leader, young Muslim leaders who were going to be chosen as role models for other Muslims. And at that point, from that point on, Muslims were going to grow up thinking it was totally fine to undermine solid acts of solidarity like BDS.
Right.
And that's what, for me, was unacceptable. I could not accept the idea that some outside force was going to create Muslim role models that were so deeply flawed in their political stances. So
do you think we give a little too much attention to the pro MLI movement? It seems, and there's no study being done on this, but it seems like the majority of Muslims in America are, you know, they would be on the BDS side, you know?
Well, I think it's a kind of counterfactual, because it's hard to argue counterfactual, because, you know, if no one had opposed it, I think that it would have had a much bigger impact. Mm. I think that the cost that was exacted on the people who went and publicly came up, like if someone went on MLI and they never said anything about it, I don't care. If somebody went on MLI and is like, I really think I made a mistake, I don't care, you know? But if people go on it and then they repeatedly come out publicly proclaiming it, praising themselves for going on it, saying how anyone who doesn't agree with them is like Pamela Geller or something, it's like the equivalent of a Pamela Geller on the other side of the spectrum, you know, yeah, then they're going to get beaten down on the head. But I mean, the point is that this, you know, if there hadn't been that cost, I think that it would have been much more successful. And I think that it would have really shifted what is normal for Muslims, that this would have become something normal. And I think, you know, the second that Trump got elected, this whole situation just changed. I mean, you know, a significant portion of the American Muslim leadership has spent the last basically 15 years building a home, a future home, with the center of the Democratic Party.
Right.
They did this with the full knowledge of two things. One, that the center Democratic Party is we're going to acquire that you give up your political stances, some things like criticism of American foreign policy and criticism of Israeli policy. These things are going to have to drop. Two, they're going to require you give up your social stances. You're going to have to get fully on board with the progressive agenda on all social issues. Okay.
Yep.
And instead of, so they made their bed with this camp, and that camp just got its rear end handed to it, because it had pushed the American public too far on social issues, and it totally neglected the economic concerns of a significant portion of the population, and had not helped the very minority groups that they were supposedly standing up for. This has all been diagnosed now ad nauseum. So the point is, now when Trump got elected, now, you know, now there's no good Muslim, bad Muslim. Now we're all bad Muslims. Unless you're Zuhdi Jasser or Asnar Rahmani, you're a bad Muslim.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all black in the sense that we're all criminalized.
Yeah.
We're all Palestinian in the sense that now we're all being told that we don't really belong in our home, you know?
Yeah.
And now we're all extremists because for people like Mike Pence and this Kris Kobach guy, you know, anybody who believes in the Quran is an extremist. So at this, there's now, you know, and by the way, I actually support partnerships with groups like AJC. And I think Muslims should have first gone and built partnerships with American Jewish organizations that actually do speak up for Muslim rights, like Jewish Voices for Peace, for example. That should have been the first group that we went to, not AJC. And by the way, the fact that this was announced the day of Trump, after Trump's election, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that means that it was in the works before Trump's election.
Oh, definitely.
You know, first of all, we should have gone with groups that really support the rights of Muslims. And two, when the Muslim Brotherhood, God forbid, gets declared a terrorist organization, whatever the hell the Muslim Brotherhood is, okay, when that gets declared a terrorist organization, and basically every Muslim organization in this country was originally sprung out of different Muslim Brotherhood activist groups in this country, okay? So basically, when every single Muslim organization and every single Muslim activist in this country is basically 1 or 2 degrees separated from a terrorist organization, is the AJC really going to stand up and protect us? Are they going to come out and say the Muslim Brotherhood is not a terrorist organization? Are they going to say that these people should not be put under a shadow of suspicion or under suspicion? If they do, I'll be impressed. But I'll tell you, ain't a lot of people going to come and support us at that moment. But you know who is going to support us? People like Black Lives Matter, people like, you know, progressive activists, or you know, the gay rights movement. They're going to support us. And, Muslims should have been building alliances more with these groups that actually come out and, you know, they might object to our social positions, but they at least don't require us to compromise on our political positions. They support our political rights. And by the way, I think, you know, even on the issue for like sexuality or gay marriage and things, I think actually really thoughtful, components of the gay rights movement, I think actually would respect Muslim position, which is, you know, we don't agree with you, you don't agree with us, but we all want the same thing, which is we want a notion of marriage, which is free from the kind of Christian Western European biases. And, you know, we want the same agenda. We don't agree with each other in terms of our lifestyles, but we have the same agenda so we can work together.
Yeah, we did have another show with you and, you know, Daniel, obviously, Daniel Hakikaju. We were talking about a little bit of LGBT stuff the other day with him, and, sounded like there's a little, it could be a little, good discussion there, but
he disagrees with me, and that's, by the way, that's a completely fine disagreement. You know, right. I also totally, you know, I thought on this issue, I thought a lot about it over the years, and I, you know, my position is, I acknowledge that there's other people who disagree with it, and that they have good arguments, and I think my argument is better, but I don't, you know, I like, you know, Imam Shafi'i said, you know, I think I'm right with the distinct possibility that I'm wrong, and I think that other people are wrong with the distinct possibility that they're right.
Very cool. Hey, we're going to try to wrap it up again. That was like a 40-minute wrap-up.
You know, yeah, well, you good, guys, man. You should have known to get me talking.
No, it was an honor having you, though, man.
What's your Twitter?
Pleasure. It was my pleasure to talk to you guys.
Dr. Brown, what's your Twitter handle and Facebook and all that stuff? Like, how can people find you online?
It's at Jonathan AC Brown. I think the A and the C and the B is capitalized, but I don't know if that matters. It's at Jonathan AC Brown.
And your father was Jonathan Brown as well, but different middle initials?
Jonathan C. Brown. So, yeah, Jonathan Cleveland Brown.
I remember the
Jonathan Andrew Cleveland Brown.
Yeah, I think I remember the Facebook post after he had passed away. You had mentioned you had like you were having dinner and stuff. So,
but I'm the last of the Brohicans.
Wait, there's no relation to that Jonathan Brown, that old preacher from like the 1700s, right? You know, that old.
No, that's Jonathan Edwards. Edwards.
Okay.
No, but I am descended from the founder of Cleveland, Ohio.
No kidding.
That's my claim to fame. And then on Facebook.
So that's where you the Cleveland Browns were.
Oh, it's the same. It's the same on Facebook. I remember this guy said you have to make everything the same. So I tried to do that. So it should be Jonathan AC Brown.
Okay. Nice. And you said you will be publishing an article in Yakin Institute so they can find some of your works there, hopefully soon, inshallah.
Yeah. I did one already on honor killing. Which I'm against, by the way. And then I did, this one will be on slavery, which awesome. I'm also against or something like that. Just to
clarify. Yeah.
Yeah. So, basically, you can look on Yakin and find stuff.
Very cool. All right. It was a pleasure having you. We'd love to have you on at some point again in the future. And I remember you were telling me when I saw you in person that you want to come to Chicago to have pita in. And I told Sim that. And I was like, yo, come on, man. We'll take us to some better restaurants. We got better places than Pita Inn.
Oh, yeah.
No. I think Pita Inn is, if there are better places, then I'm happy to find them.
Like, other places, like Bawadi. Have you had Bawadi?
No, I haven't.
Don't think it's a baladi.
You guys can invite me to Chicago and then take me to this place.
Oh, definitely.
Absolutely. All right. For our listeners out there, if you have any questions or comments, you can email us at themadmumlukes@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @themadmumlukes. Like our Facebook page by the same name. We are on iTunes, so please subscribe and leave us a 5-star rating. For our special guest, Dr. Jonathan Brown, and for my co-hosts, Sheikh Amir Saeed and Sim, this is Mahin. We're the Mad Mamluks, signing off. Assalamu alaikum.
Alright, song.